Thank you very much for coming for our annual participation in the C. Henry Smith Peace Oratorical Contest. I'm Nancy Heise. I teach in the Bible and Religion Department. Bible and Religion, together with the Department of Applied Social Sciences and the Language and Literature Department, host this Peace Oratorical Contest each year. The contest was established in 1974 by the directors of the C. Henry Smith Trust as a way of honoring the late Mennonite historian who taught at Goshen and Bluffton and was well known for his numerous books on Mennonite history. C. Henry Smith was particularly attentive to the peace commitment of the Mennonite tradition. This contest is sponsored annually by Peace and Justice Ministries of Mennonite Central Committee U.S., and students from every Mennonite and Brethren in Christ College in North America, both Canada and the U.S., are eligible to participate. EMU has participated in this event since 2003, with EMU students winning the grand prize in the bi-national level in 2003, 2004, 2007, 2009, and 2011. EMU speakers placed second in 2012 in the bi-national contest and third in 2013. So no pressure, anybody. We've done very well, and we're very proud of all the students who participate. We are also tonight especially grateful for our three judges for this year's event, and they're seated there in the midst of you all. Please respect their need for space. They will be, after each speaker, they will be taking some time to do their notations, so give them the space to do that work. Our judges are Jennifer Davis Sensenig, who is the lead pastor at Community Mennonite Church here in Harrisonburg, Dr. David Evans, assistant professor of history, mission, intercultural and interfaith studies at Eastern Mennonite Seminary, and Dr. Jane Dougherty, who's professor of leadership and public policy and program director at the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding. We thank them all for your time and your energy. Let's give them a hand. This year, we have five contestants, and you have their names on the program that you received as you arrived. Each of them are applying the Christian peace position to a contemporary concern. They have drawn numbers, and they will proceed in this order. First, Chris Parks. Second, Seth Stauffer. Third, Chris Yoder. Fourth, Sarah Caitlin Newbert. And five, Jordan Luther. After each speech, we will give the judges some time to record their notes and comments. There are refreshments in the lobby. You're welcome to go out and move around. Please don't bring any food in here, but you may help yourself out there. And we will give you a signal when we're ready for the next speech to begin. We keep the door shut during speeches so that the speakers aren't distracted by coming and going. This is a wonderful opportunity for us to listen to EMU students who have thought long and hard about this. They've worked hard in consultation with others, and I am very excited to listen to what each of them will have to say. And so we will begin with our first speaker, Chris Parks. Chris is a biblical studies and theater major. He's a junior, and his speech is titled Dreaming a New America.
As I stand here, I am reminded of the people who have come before me. Vincent Harding, Michelle Alexander, Langston Hughes, W.E.B. Du Bois, Joe Shriver, Donald Crable, Apostle Paul. I must bow my head and remember I can be nothing, will never be anything, if it were not for those who have paved the way for my feet to trod. Langston Hughes once said, "Oh yes, I say it plain, America never was America to me, and yet I swear by this oath, America will be." As a 22-year-old black queer whose hair droops like the branches of a willow, my heart grieves for the America that never was for me. The NAACP reports, 1 in 3 black men between the ages of 20 and 35 were behind bars in 2012, and far more were under some form of penal control, such as probation or parole. I am the one that got away. Yet, I constantly look over my shoulder. Quote, "It is not uncommon for young black teenagers living in the hood to be stopped, interrogated, and frisked numerous times in the course of a month or even a single week, often by paramilitary units, Alexander. To see the security officer watch me as I buy groceries. To look at the local store owner watch me buying a new shirt. To experience cops pull me over driving home from church in a beat-up car while black." Quote, "In United States versus Bergoni Ponce, the court concluded it permissible under the Equal Protection Act of the 14th Amendment for police to use race as a factor in making decisions about which motorists to stop Alexander. This is what America is. Every day, I must be as white as I can and assimilate. Assimilation. The process whereby individuals or groups of differing ethnic heritages are absorbed into the dominant culture of a society. Who am I in the midst of assimilation? I am resilient. I am the descendant of a heritage five generations back. My ancestors hung resembling the Christ I hold dear. I am strong. My Choctaw ancestors migrated from the bayous of Mississippi to the plains of Oklahoma. I am intelligent. Grandchild of a woman in her 70s finishing seminary this coming May. I am black. W.E.B. Du Bois declared, the child of twilight and night, and choose intrinsically curly hair, black eyes, full and luscious features, and that air of humility and wonder which streams from moonlight. Whiteness. Call me articulate, as if I am not supposed to be or able to. Ask about my food and not the culture from which it comes. Yes, be surprised when you look at my locks and can't fathom how I can make you feel welcomed and safe. Touch my hair and ask me if it's real. Look confused when I can keep up talking about Shakespeare and Origen and Aristotle and Menno Simons and Plato and Augustine. Yes, I know more than just twerking, Beyonce, and the latest trending artist, whiteness. I am losing my culture. Vogue. Ballroom scene. A gathering of people of color as sacred space for gays, femme realness, butch realness, dramatic vogue, queers, sex sirens, losing my language. When everyone is girl, throwing shade, seas of snaps, losing my music. Dropping a beat, encouraging movement, losing my dance. Duck walks, give them hands, give them face, dips, drops, dramatics, my pride. Quote, ballroom culture was not only born out of the need to respond to racism and heteronormativity, it was a response to heterofascism, gender normativity, conformity, and the socioeconomic oppression enforced by classism, ursprung. I am losing my heritage. They didn't teach me about Vincent Harding, Bayard Rustin, the Black Power movement, the Stonewall riots, My history text isn't my story, my history. Read the story told. Who is it about? Are there truly any Black, Latina, Asian, or Indigenous stories? Of course not. History textbooks aren't for me. Not to empower me. Not to tell the greatness of my people. Who gives voice to the stories written for history's sake? Who's the editor-in-chief that governs the pages of my history text privilege? Those who benefit, define, fit, enforce the processes, attributes, perspectives, standards, and ways of relating that characterize the traditional and dominant paradigm power. The ability to influence the behaviors of others with or without resistance. The possession of these is like a balancing act. We are gifted with both. But the degree is disproportional and oppressive. Access to resources, quality education, healthy food, music, culture. This list is expansive. Each of us has many of these in some form between abundance and scarcity. I hear time and time again, this conversation framed in power and privilege, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Shriver explains, one fundamental characteristic of oppression is the categorization of people, things, and ideas in terms of their difference from one another, separateness. Labels are second nature. Not labels for the sake of self-awareness, labels to sit us at different tables. We've created race to be an agent of division. Apostle Paul, in his letter to the church of Ephesus, declared, "For Christ is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down the dividing wall of hostility, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby bringing hostility to an end." Christ calls into reconciliation. Christ beckons us to the table. How long will our communion tables be full of people who look, act, think, talk like us? How long will unity be synonymous with conformity of thought? Hughes yearns. Let America be the dreams dreamers dreamed. Crable articulates. The spirit of Jesus penetrates social boxes. Barricades of suspension, mistrust, and stigma, and hate crumble in his presence. Jesus, fully human, fully divine, models for us how to live. Jesus isn't the only great liberator. We are. This community as a whole embodies who Christ was and is for our world. I dream with and as Christ. I dream America when my Black community is saying no to oppressive voices, when no more Black and Latino bodies are being exploited by a system that never was for us, when our schools are not being closed and prisons on the cusp of grand openings, when Black and Latino male-bodied folk are not being pushed through school to the prison system, when cultural differences bless the land, when race is no longer about positions of power, when we can critically think about power and privilege, I dream America. When peace is a full table, when peace is Christ and the full body, when peace is no longer a concept that blows in the wind, but we see it as practical and a way of life, I dream America. Crable asserts, all are invited to the table in the new kingdom. I can't stop dreaming, America. This is the place of my roots. This is the place my ancestors worked and pained for me to live, be, and thrive. Have you stopped dreaming, America? I dream of my vocation. I can't stop dreaming. I dream of God's kingdom on earth. I can't stop dreaming of Christ's reign in the world. I dream about a spouse and children. I will be damned if you tell me to stop dreaming. Dreaming of equal access to resources, no matter sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, race, creed, socioeconomic status, your home address, or your last name. I refuse to stop dreaming, America. My life depends on dreams. Come to the table and dream.
Our second speaker is Seth Stauffer. Seth is a senior peacebuilding and development major. The title of his speech is The Danger of MCC's Own Single Story.
The Christian peace position is a radical thing. Radical, like students in the civil rights movement, in organizing restaurant sit-ins at the cost of their physical beatings, verbal abuse, and extensive jail time. The Christian peace position is radical, like the Canadian abolitionist Bass from 12 Years a Slave, who risks his life to free Solomon Northup. Radical practice, often in the form of a costly embrace, is essential to the Christian peace position. Mennonites and organizations like Mennonite Central Committee are good at acting out their radical peace position. Their stubborn, nonviolent resistance in the face of violence is one of their strengths. That being said, Mennonites often have significant trouble knowing how to communicate violence. On the one hand, it is glorified in the example of the Menno martyrs. On the other hand, it is repressed from the Mennonite identity. Many progressive Mennonites, for example, have divorced themselves from images of a violent God. For Mennonites, violence is unacceptable, and it is to be rejected and avoided at all costs. Millions have viewed Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's TED Talk, The Danger of a Single Story. Adichie's speech was shared widely, perhaps among Mennonites more than most groups, and among Mennonites, it was shared most comprehensively to employees and volunteers of Mennonite Central Committee. As it turns out, I was one of those volunteers last summer, and I quickly discovered that the 4-year-old TED Talk had become essential working knowledge for all MCC staff. Adichie's talk names how impressionable and vulnerable we are in the face of a story. She describes how one story is never enough. Only one story robs people of dignity and forecloses the possibility of human complexity and connection. Furthermore, stories are a matter of power. How they are told, who tells them, when they are told, how many stories are told, are really dependent on power. For Adichie, power is the ability not just to tell the story of another person, but to make it the definitive story of that person. It is no wonder the talk became so popular in MCC circles so quickly. The synergy of the danger of a single story with MCC's peace position is extensive. Both are intended to be subversive strokes, undermining power hierarchies and the dominant narrative to make space for everyone and all stories. The synergy is there for MCC because the organization does not have a naively humanist peace position. MCC has a Christian peace position, and at times that means following the path of radical, nonviolent resistance. The TED Talk was so important to MCC because it articulated a powerful operating guideline. It reinforced MCC's care for all stories, and most importantly for the topic today, gave MCC a seemingly fail-safe way to communicate. It gave MCC the option to focus on telling many stories and to let the popular media stories of the world remain unchallenged. In adopting Adichie's powerful words, MCC risks losing its radical subversiveness. When the catchphrase, "the danger of a single story," is used without Adichie's complexity, it is all too easy to become formulaic, to adopt one's own version of the straight-edged, acceptable single story. It is all too easy to soften the Christian peace position and leave the dominant stories be. Recent Oscar-awarded Best Picture, 12 Years a Slave, exemplifies this. The movie tells the story of Solomon Northup, a free man who is taken and sold into slavery. The film documents Northup's 12 years of abuse around the 1840s, and it does not shy away from inviting the audience to see slavery vicariously through painfully long stationary camera shots of a hanging and beatings. It is only too natural for the typical danger of a single story indoctrinated Mennonite to suggest that 12 Years a Slave shows too much violence, that it desensitizes us to violence, and implicitly that it represents the single story of violence in slavery. It is true, there is a fine line between desensitizing and realizing, between getting used to violence and seeing violence become unacceptable. This is where we need Adichie's complexity. Adichie argues that it is not that the single story is untrue, it is that the single story is necessarily incomplete. It is true that retelling the story of slavery risks giving a single story of horrific brutality, and that single story is necessarily incomplete. But too long have the sterile and tidy slave narratives created a comfortable story disconnected from a monstrous past of slavery. Too often have we repeated our collective trauma and maintained the cycle of violence rather than using the power of stories to acknowledge and heal the trauma. 12 Years a Slave opens possibilities for acknowledging the trauma of slavery we have failed to acknowledge in the past. It is true there is a danger in the single story of violence. However, it is also true that there is as much danger in fearing the single story to the point of neglecting important narratives. Last summer, I was a volunteer English teacher with MCC Honduras. I planned to write a blog and was encouraged to do so by MCC Honduras staff. From the start of my orientation, we talked about blogging and how perceptions of Honduras are communicated to people in the US. The biggest concern for the staff was about how violence is communicated. Honduras has the highest murder rate in the world, and popular representations of Honduras in the media focus exclusively on its violence and drug trafficking. The MCC staff encouraged me to approach the topic of violence with Adichie's talk in mind. I was encouraged to tell the stories of Honduras, but to avoid talking about violence in Honduras. My experiences made it important for me to try to talk about violence, to acknowledge the narrative, to begin to work through it for those reading my blog and for myself. I drafted a blog acknowledging Honduras's statistic of having the highest murder rate in the world and acknowledging the violence I had witnessed and experienced. The most extreme example that I wrote about was being just down the city street in Tegucigalpa from a murder. I saw a crowd gathering around the house where it happened, onlookers or family perhaps. My blog concluded by saying that although I had witnessed violence, even though I was just down the street when it happened, one can only imagine the violence in Honduras. My blog readers, and now you as well, have experienced the violence as directly as I had, as the reality of violence is left to the imagination. I concluded by writing that perceptions of violence are dependent on the stories one chooses to hear and how one uses all of those stories. 86 murders per 100,000 people can be one's only story of Honduras. I'll take the other stories too. I decided to pass this blog along to MCC's staff because we had previously talked about the importance of communicating violence carefully, and I knew it was an issue with which they were concerned. The staff responded, advising that it would be best to leave out my experiences with violence, especially the murder. They deemed it inappropriate content for an MCC worker's blog. MCC named the single story of Honduras as violence and censored my approach to that single story. I viewed my blog as a way of communicating and complicating perceptions of violence. I wanted to undermine assumptions about violence, to open up possibilities for reworking the popular narrative. MCC viewed my blog as buying into this single story, dramatizing and reinforcing the dominant narrative. This is not to say MCC was completely wrong about my blog. In some ways, just talking about violence will reinforce popular assumptions and maintain its status as a dominant narrative. But in this case, MCC has similarly adopted a single story to compensate against the dominant narrative. By censoring experiences of violence, MCC risks falling into the Mennonite trap of not knowing how to communicate stories of violence in radical ways. MCC risks not affecting or subverting those dominant narratives, even when it is within their power to do so. Just as 12 Years a Slave forces its American audience to view violence as deplorable and incomprehensible rather than as the epitome of entertainment, MCC needs to communicate the truth of violence as something that is neither inevitable nor acceptable, rather than leaving the dominant narrative run its course. There is a critical difference between sharing a generalization of violence and sharing a personalization of violence. The danger of the single story is in the incompleteness of a generalization. I was in Honduras experiencing violence, and it was more than a statistic or a generalization. I lived with people who wouldn't go out at night, who have to pay gangs for their safety. I was giving voice to that experience by telling their particular story, not the single story. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie concludes her TED Talk by saying that when we reject the single story, when we realize that there is never a single story about any place, we regain a kind of paradise. The Mennonite community, including you, me, and groups like MCC, need to challenge dominant narratives of violence. Following the example of 12 Years a Slave, we need to share our particular stories about violence to break down generalizations. We need to see violence as neither inevitable nor acceptable. Let us acknowledge our stories of violence. Let us retell those particular stories, and let us never give in to a single generalized story of violence. Thank you.
Our third speaker is Chris Yoder. Chris is a senior writing studies major, and his title is The Scaffolding of Our Existence.
Hello, everybody. Picture the Lion King. Most of you have probably seen the movie. If you haven't, I'll wager you know it takes place in Africa. So better yet, picture the setting African sun, a red orb melting onto the horizon, a dusty haze lingering. You sit on an anthill watching this sun set. Now for clarity, by anthill, I mean a 12-foot tall, 20-foot wide termite mound with shrubs and trees covering the surface. You sit in crisscross shadows of light. The red sun is setting, and dust-filled sunbeams like little yellow lasers pierce through the leaves. A line of termites with swollen black heads stream to and from the cracker crumbs right by your lap, crumbs broken off from the wafers now churning in your stomach. You look down at the termites. You look to a neighboring anthill about 100 feet up the path. Now, say you picked up one of these termites, carried it to that neighboring anthill, and put it down directly on the peak. What would happen to this little bug? From what I understand, the termite queen controls each and every individual termite on her hill. Her wish is not their command, it's their necessary obligation. They don't have a choice. She's in them from their hardened exoskeleton down to their vulnerable organs. So this termite you've placed on the neighboring anthill now has a new queen. Its inbred instructions to play a specific role in its former hive are now moot. It has new instructions to follow while fighting the innate calling of its previous self. Well, what does it do? I can tell you this much. It doesn't survive. It dies. But now let's shift to something away from death. Humans, on the other hand, can move from anthill to anthill and don't die in the process. Humans have a unique ability, uncommon to many lower order species, to adapt psychologically within their lifespan to a completely new set of overarching rules, rules similar to this termite queen's omnipotence over her subordinates. In the words of David Primack, emeritus professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, animals can perceive perceptual relations. Humans alone can reinterpret the higher order relations between these relations. These higher order relations or rules of different anthills are what we call culture. So how do humans do it? How do we adapt to new anthills? How do we have the ability to perceive these higher order relations? Here's an example. A college student named Jimmy signs up for a cross-cultural trip to Kenya. He packs his toothbrush, his clothes, his shiny new camera, his little white malaria meds, and hops on a plane across the pond. He gets off the plane, immediately starts sweating, pulls his shirt sleeves up, nudges his buddy, and says, "Wouldn't it be great if we had weather like this back home?" Then he pops a malaria pill for safety's sake. And then, after the all-too-short orientation, he's thrown into a house with a host family, and he sends a text to his buddy, "Yo, man, this is awesome. This is the real deal. We're living the African life." Things go well the first day. Introductions are pleasant, and everybody's friendly, like usual. Then the food begins to sit wrong. The heat proves that Jimmy's clothing choice was horribly misguided. The mosquitoes bite nonstop and buzz and whine underneath the frayed mosquito net. More little white pills are consumed. Now, there comes a point in Jimmy's story where he must make a choice that will determine the psychological outcome of all future interactions with his host family, with the community he finds himself in, and with the culture he is now in as well. He must ask himself, will I reinterpret my identity and cultural assumptions to adapt to the rules of this new culture, or will I continue to apply my previous culture's rules upon this one? According to Petru Derevenko, member of the Romanian Academy of Medical Sciences, the choice Jimmy makes will indicate his capacity to psychologically adapt. Derevenko implies a direct correlation between perceived human stressors and human adaptation. His basic concept is this, and stick with me here, it gets a little deep. According to perceived stress from the human brain comes from four main sources. One, individual differences between people, like genes, development, and experience. Two, trauma and or abuse. That's pretty self-explanatory. Three, major life events such as a near-death experience, or perhaps Jimmy's cross-cultural. Four, environmental stressors like one's work, home, or neighborhood. Once the brain processes these perceived stressors, it results in either a physiological response or a behavioral response. These both lead to what Derevenko calls an allostatic load. Allostasis now, or the body's ability to balance change, exists on a continuum with adaptation lurking at its opposite pole. The human, Derevenko argues, reacts to stress either by conserving previous values, a byproduct of stagnation in allostasis, or progressing towards new values, which is a byproduct of adaptation. In visual terms, it's basically a scaffolding of values in our brain. We build these structures in our head based on past experiences. When a new experience comes our way, it either affirms what we already know or it challenges our worldview. With those that challenge our worldview, picture a wrecking ball swinging at full tilt towards your scaffolding. We have a choice in this moment. We can erect our walls stronger so the wrecking ball clangs off of it, which would be a conservation of our previous values. Or we can allow the wrecking ball to shatter the scaffolding and start building anew from this point of impact, which would be progressing towards new values or adapting. Now, both of these, if applied to actual scaffolding, would do quite a bit of damage. Imagine a wrecking ball crashing into scaffolding. Without getting into the physics, it's a hell of a force. If you hold up your hand right now and attempt to keep it steady, and I take a big old windup and hit it as hard as I can, it's going to hurt quite a bit. But if you give with the blow, pain is lessened. In the battles raging in our identity, continued battering from a new culture will wear a body down. Absorbing the cultural blows, however, displays a person's ability to progress towards new values or adapt. It just so happens that there's another name for this phenomenon, too. It's love. At its core, love is the openness to allow new people and ideas to imprint a bit of themselves on your being. It's essentially allowing somebody to reveal themselves to you in a deeply personal way. You hear what they say, and granted you're making an effort to actually listen to what they're saying, it pastes itself onto your persona. This imprint in part then manifests itself physiologically or behaviorally in future interactions with people. The brain interprets this new idea as one of these wrecking balls or as one of Derevyanko's perceived stressors that instigates the process of adaptation. So now, through all that, it becomes apparent that love is a key force driving adaptation. We started on a termite mound, looking at cracker crumbs and insects, and transitioned to the brain's capacity to psychologically adapt to new anthills. And stressors, like the wrecking ball hurtling towards the scaffolding, force the brain to make a decision. It can conserve what it already has or progress towards something new. Love, similar to adaptation, is a force that drives the world. It's the ability to allow another person or group of people into your being, thus incorporating that person into your future actions, whether or not the decision to do so is conscious or subconscious. For Jimmy in Kenya, it's allowing the wrecking ball named Kenyan culture to break his scaffolding. Now, I realize that if you think you're strong and never allow your scaffolding to be shattered by the wrecking ball, it will grow pretty tall. In fact, it might even reach the heavens. But as evident by the story of the Tower of Babel, it's kind of hard to build a tall tower when you don't speak the language of those you're building it with. So let the wrecking ball knock down your attempts at reaching the heavens. Let yourself love the culture's attempted intrusion, and in doing so, you'll find that love is the structure and support for your identity by means of bonding together a medley of cultures. Meanwhile, Jimmy decides to allow Kenyan culture to have some reign over his identity. Jimmy decides to become a culture mutt. I don't blame him. Mutts live longer than purebreds, and that is a fact. But in allowing this culture to enter his psyche, he now loves the new culture, thus building his identity not on the platform of individualistic trial and error, but on the fusion of an unfathomable number of identities. He's letting the little children come, red, yellow, black, and white. They're all precious in his sight. He's working with people to build a tower of diversity that doesn't need to reach the heavens, only cover all the earth. So the next time you feel the wrecking ball approach, allow it to shatter your scaffolding. Allow it to come in, see what it's like. Feel it out, rub your toes together, twiddle your thumbs. Be prepared to have your world rocked and learn to live.
Our fourth speaker is Sarah Caitlin Newbert. She's a first-year computer science major, and her presentation is titled, "We're Not Ugly, We Just Stink."
Body image is the perception a person has of themselves. It feeds self-confidence, and self-confidence sets the tone in which a person will approach the events and people in their day. A child with a healthy body image is more likely to interact with peers during physical activities and in a classroom setting, which allows them to develop interpersonal conflict and problem-solving skills. These social-related skills enable a person to make choices and build relationships that lead to success during school and in the workplace and beyond. An unhealthy body image can lead to feelings of inadequacy, anxiety, and self-doubt. When this suffering occurs and an individual doesn't seek or receive sufficient help, it affects their ability to build social skills they need to thrive. A person's poor perception of themselves is caused by external influences, such as celebrities, advertising, and other forms of media. Society's definition of beauty and its influence on the definition of health can lead people to obsess over physical appearance and lose sight of their core values and their life goals. Fellow peers and family can also impact a person's body image. Negative words and the awareness of judgment can cause cause pressure to conform and seek self-worth by working to gain the acceptance of others. It is impossible to eliminate these bad influences. However, the church as a community has the ability to be a positive influence. By placing a Christian outlook on the ideology of health and beauty, the church can positively impact an individual's body image, thus making it easier to develop these valuable life skills. Philippians 2:16 reads, "It is by holding fast to the word of life, so that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I do not run in vain or labor in vain." God didn't put us here on earth for us to worry about our outwardly appearance. We are made to worship him. A popular solution to poor body image is to set a goal that I want to become skinny or gain curves or become muscular. However, these vague goals can lead to constant dissatisfaction and extreme actions that only lead to further mental and physical danger. For example, a person who looks in the mirror and sees himself as fat will begin intensive exercise regimens and cut their food intake to amounts much lower than is healthy with that combination of workout. If the church encourages the idea that health and beauty is not defined by outward appearance, but by one's ability to fulfill God's will, it will reshape the community's way of thinking. In the words of SpongeBob, in an episode of SpongeBob SquarePants, where he too struggles with self-confidence, "We're not ugly, we just stink." Telling people to be proud of whom they are and not listening to anyone else is nice, but it's not solving the problem. The creation of healthy body image is not something that can be done in a day, and it certainly cannot be done alone. So stop trying to fix the ugly on the outside and start focusing on fixing the smelly on the inside. Writing this speech has been a slow and hard process. Part of the reason I chose this topic on body image was to inform the public that, as I've learned through my own experience, a healthy body is something that can't be obtained in a day. We go to church to seek guidance in the scripture and through others, slowly developing our relationship with God. The process of developing a healthy body is the same way. That being said, each time I met my advisor for this contest to talk about what I had so far, she would mention that I had yet to talk about anything personal to me. I didn't want to talk about my struggles. I wanted to stand on stage and make you believe that self-confidence and those issues were completely cured. I wanted to achieve the very notion that I'm speaking against. I remember standing in front of the mirror with my mom one morning when I was about 6 as she was getting ready for school, or not school, but just for the day. And she was combing her hair, and so I mimicked by combing my hair. And then she would sweep cream and powder along her face, and I mimicked her by rubbing my hands all over my face. And then for a moment, she leaned in to check to make sure her mascara was okay before putting on her lipstick. And so I leaned in too, and then I noticed those big, hairy eyebrows, dark black on my face. And I looked at my mom and I said, "I wish I had your eyebrows. They were so delicate and light." and she laughed and said she wished she had mine. But that didn't matter. That was the first time I became completely aware of how I looked in comparison to others. From then on, the comparisons never stopped. In middle school, I wanted so badly to have the really voluminous and wavy hair that you see on all the commercials. And throughout high school, I loathed the fact that, like, my stomach popped out more than my boobs. And the first year of college has been just a roller coaster of emotions. I ran cross country last semester, and I slimmed up quite a bit. And I was, for the first time, I was feeling really pretty. In fact, I felt so good that I would go to church and chapel just so I could doll myself up and show off. And I never listened to what was actually being said during those services. As the semester went on, I became sick, and it became really hard for me to run. And once the cross-country season was over, I stopped exercising completely. So, of course, I started to regain the weight. I lost all of my muscle. I still went to chapel, and I still didn't listen because I was constantly fixing my skirt and pulling up my tights, just hoping and wishing I looked prettier. Then, one day, a friend invited me to go to his church, a Korean evening service at one of the local Mennonite churches near campus. When I walked in that Sunday, I was so self-conscious. I already felt really out of place being the only American, and the fact that I had all these issues with my body only made it worse. And we sat down in the front row, and the sermon began with singing, followed with individual prayer that was spoken out loud. All the eyes shut and heads were bowed, and prayers began to be offered up. I looked around, and I saw one of the most humbling sights I've ever experienced. There was no one judging me. There was no one judging anyone. Here everyone was, thanking the Lord, asking for guidance, asking for forgiveness, all at once, out loud, for anyone to hear. And not a single soul seemed to be concerned about what another person might think. Complete vulnerability within the safety of a church community. One of the priorities of the Mennonite Central Committee, as listed on their website, states, "We show our love for others by looking out for the interests of not just our own." Based on the verse 2:4 of Philippians, which says, let each of you look out not only for your own benefits, but also for the interest of others. With that in mind, let us work as a community to create a better perspective on beauty and encourage truly healthy goals in ourselves and in others to be fulfilled over time, so that we may not only gain social skills, but develop as Christians.
Our fifth presenter is Jordan Luther. Jordan is a junior biblical studies major, and his presentation is titled, "Are Y'all Listening? An Apology."
There's a burning question deep within my soul, which has occupied my most recent thinking. Do our experiences shape our use of language, or does our use of language shape our experiences? Ludwig Wittgenstein, one of the great 20th century philosophers, once said, Language is a part of our organism and no less complicated than it. His response is a bit too pithy for my taste, yet nonetheless proverbial. His insights invite us to think of our use of language and personhood not as competing components, but rather as collaborative companions. Following Wittgenstein's footsteps, I too want to acknowledge the complexity of language and provide some of my own reflections and experiences as a sort of apologetic act. This speech, however, is an apology in both senses of the word. This speech is an act of sorrow, and yet a spirited defense on my behalf with the full intentions of inspiring a new level of sensitivity towards those of us who speak with Southern accents. I believe I first became self-aware about this link between language and identity while I was making the transition from elementary school to middle school. Now, I know what you're probably thinking. All right, Jordan, there is no way you can be that self-aware at such a fragile age. Are you sure you're not just hyper self-conscious about when your voice started changing? Sure. I mean, I was a bit self-conscious in middle school when it came to my voice, and it would fluctuate between high and low pitches uncontrollably. This developmental stage of my life certainly draws the connections between how my struggle for a sense of voice influenced my evolving sense of identity. However, this is not the event I had in mind. On the contrary, instead of focusing on the puberty experience many middle school boys seem to go through these days, I want to focus on a more localized, regional reality from my childhood, the social reality of growing up in the American South. Allow me to paint a picture for you. I grew up in Martinsville, Virginia, a decaying factory town in the southwestern part of the state. Well, I actually didn't grow up in Martinsville. Rather, my family and I call Henry County home and have a rural Martinsville address. It is this subtle nuance of geography and space that provides the context for my initial sense of self and social awareness in middle school. In elementary school, I was with other rural kids in a small school called Figsboro Elementary, which was fairly close to my home. In middle school, however, all of a sudden, I was exposed to more kids from different parts of the county and the city of Martinsville. Some kids came from rural elementary schools, like me, while others came from elementary schools closer to town. And it was not that hard to hear the difference between the two groups. How did we manage to do it, you might ask? The main distinction was whether or not one spoke with a country accent or not. There was one time in the sixth grade where I don't think I said so much as a single sentence when the boy I was talking to decided he had heard enough to crack the code of where I came from. "Hey, Jordan," he said teasingly with an exaggerated drawl. "You don't happen to be one of them Fixborough kids, do you? 'Cause you sure do sound like it." Believe it or not, even after such a rude comment, we managed to be pretty good friends throughout middle school. Now, you can call me a saint if you wish, but maybe I should first mention that this nuance between those with country accents, like me, and those without them, like my friend in this illustration, is quite insignificant in the grand scheme of my identity formation. To be completely honest, all of us had accents. Apparently Southern accents, but we never realized it at the time. We were all so used to hearing our parents and grandparents talk with their Southern drawl, there was never an opportunity for us to critically evaluate our Southern accents because, well, that was considered normal. The more disconcerting part of my narrative, though, is when I was blindsided with the reality of what it apparently means to have a Southern accent to the ears of those who do not have one. The summer before I entered EMU is when my identity and my accent, which is inseparable from it, was challenged in such a stiff way. It was the end of a near-perfect summer at the Christian camp where I worked. All the summer staff were gathered around at a closing campfire, sharing stories and reflections about from the past camp season. a coworker of mine casually approached me, all cheery and smiley from all the emotion in the air, I suppose. "You know, Jordan," he said to me, "I never would have guessed you were so intelligent and insightful, judging by the sound of your accent." His comment stung me like a dagger, despite its intended purpose as a compliment. Initially, I was shocked and perplexed and thought it would be best to respond with the simple, "Thank you." Long after the campfire ended, however, I continued to pick away at all the undertones of his comment. Could it be that he expected ignorance out of me, but I gave him intelligence instead? I believe that is what haunts me the most about our interaction. My accent was no longer heard as a geographical or regional identity marker. Rather, my accent had been reduced to a stereotype of perceived intellect, where I was the exception, but not the rule. I lament this realization as I continue to experience the daily effects of moments such as these and how they have permanently tattooed my conscience. My southern drawl and twang, which used to come so naturally to me, I'm afraid is being replaced with the more standardized American English vernacular. It's not the accommodation part that I find most bothersome. This is quite natural, and it's a natural process to adjust one's speech, even if it's subtle, in order to match those around you. What bothers me the most, though, is the culturally implied message that my southern accent cannot be taken seriously outside of the South. Okay, so why do I even bring all this up? Why do I feel the necessity to share my story with all y'all? Well, for starters, I want to reveal the struggle of what it's like for us with Southern accents, to feel the pressure to assimilate in order to feel heard. Secondly, it is within this struggle to feel heard where my critique and resolution lies. To hear someone else is no hard task. It doesn't take a linguist to hear nuances or differences in another person's speech. I've been heard my whole life, and quite frankly, I'm tired of it. I don't want to be heard anymore. My soul longs for more people to stop hearing and to start listening, and I don't think I need a dictionary when I make the distinction between being heard and being listened to. To listen to another is to be engaged with the speaker and to assume the posture of a learner. To listen to another is to acknowledge your own worldview and how you choose to express it and interpret it linguistically. To listen to another is to venerate the dignity and the experiences of the other with the precious words he or she chooses to utilize. So tell me, friends, are y'all listening? As Christians and as agents of peace, I want to inspire all of us to think of listening as an exercise of our hospitality. Hospitality requires an acute level of self and social awareness. One must discern when it is appropriate to extend hospitality and when it is appropriate to receive hospitality, given the context of each situation. Furthermore, one cannot assume to extend hospitality is the greater role and to receive hospitality is the subordinate role, because hospitality is fundamentally a holistic experience. This same logic applies to listening to those with Southern accents. When you listen, your role is just as active as the speaker's. When you listen, you speak to comprehend not only the message of the speaker, but the social context which surrounds it too. When you listen, you accept the speaker's extension of hospitality like a gift. Friends, my accent is inherently a gift. Now, will you accept it?